The Off the Ball Podcast Network.
Into sports.
20 yards out. Urge to shoot. Don't shoot. Oh, what a goal from Fabinho. Wow.
And get into the all new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him. Yeah, no.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Before all that, we'll turn to our next guest. He's lived a pretty remarkable rugby life. In many ways, it's taken him from Dublin and Leinster and the Irish under-20s to what seemed like a certain retirement, and then random circumstances combined, and Ian McKinley found himself playing out half for the Italian national team. He has recently returned to these shores, aged 30 now. He's doing some coaching in Derry with Rainy Old Boys Club in Division 2A of the AIL. Ian McKinley, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
No worries. Thanks very much for having me.
No, it's great to have you on. So, old, rainy old boys in Derry, Division 2A of the AIL. I wouldn't have said this was the natural move for an Italian international out half. How did all this come about?
Yeah, I think, the coronavirus has thrown up a serious amount of challenges for people recently. And I've ended up moving back here because my wife is from these parts. And I think just with all these uncertain times, I think it's just after 10 years of nearly been abroad, I think it's just good to take stock and, be closer to family. So, yeah, I've ended up accepting a post to be backs coach for the Rainy Old Boys. So started there a few days ago. So exciting times ahead.
I was reading you were one of 8 players who left Benetton at the end of this season. Was that enforced on them by COVID and just the financial implications for everybody?
No, I think some guys were, they were retiring. Me, I actually knew pretty early on as the season started that I unfortunately wasn't going to be offered a new contract. So I had a good bit of preparation to decide what I was going to do next. But this decision is sort of due to the coronavirus has come a bit quicker coming back to Ireland. But now happy to be back here.
Okay. And are you retired or let's wait and see?
Oh, it's definitely let's wait and see. I think you even saw the RFU today, having to cut a huge amount of wages and even previously having to cut a huge amount of jobs. There's just so much uncertainty at the moment. And I think it would be unwise for me to make any sort of decision like that, to make a rash decision. And, just as I said, unprecedented times and who knows what we're going to be like, let alone in 6 months' time. So I think it's while I'm here, it's good that you can get stuck into community projects. And I have heard a lot about Rainy before, would you believe? Because I played my first ever senior game for UCD 12 years ago against them, and obviously my wife being from this area, you hear and hear results, and keep an eye on the team. So met the squad and they're a good bunch of lads.
Okay, great. I mean, I know you've long had an interest in coaching. Conor O'Shea was on the record in the past to say that he thinks you'll make an excellent coach. And I was reading a quote from you. You said you've taken a team in every club that you've been at. I think you were working with the academy over in Benetton. So it's something clearly you're interested in.
Yeah, when I retired, aged 21, Leinster were very good with me as well. Just opening the door and letting me watch academy sessions or taking an under-17s team. I remember with John Fogarty, we took a team against Cardiff, I think it was. And, it's always, been a huge interest for me. And, you actually, I think, grow as a player as well, learning to, be able to, speak to players and try and develop them. So it's definitely an area that I'm that I'm interested in.
So backs coach, AIL, Division 2A, Rainy Old Boys, is there much you can take from international rugby and offer to that standard? Is it pretty similar, totally different?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that you just get to know the people that you're working with. Guys are out there either studying or, working hard in their day jobs. So I think, first and foremost, you want to, obviously, any team that you're with, you want to improve the standard of what they're doing and maybe impart some wisdom. But for me as well, I'll be, you know, learning from them on how to, you know, adapt and deal in certain situations. And you know, as I said, I was there up on Thursday night, and it was absolutely lashing rain, you know, much like Italian weather in August time. But and you know, the skill level was actually pretty high, and I was very impressed. And you know, the squad is good, so you know, hopefully we'll just feed off each other, and you know, it'll be a successful season. But again, it's just it's not like normal, you know, with fans not being there or anything like that. So it's but it's been a good start anyway.
And would you have coaching ambitions long term, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, I would, but I definitely, I understand that almost if you're not fortunate enough to get a job straight away and with the first team, you almost have to start at the bottom of the barrel again, like working your way up to becoming a professional rugby player. So as you alluded to there, I've basically been part-time coaching as well as playing since 2011. So as I said, it's just a big interest of mine. So we'll see what happens, and just try learn as much as you can along the way.
Mm. Was there a sadness in leaving Italy? Did it feel like home? Had you become very comfortable and bedded into the Italian way of life?
Yeah, I'd be lying if I didn't say I'm, you know, missed it terribly. The sun is definitely a bit of a difference, and but it's a totally different way of life, and you know, fortunate enough to just be a 2-hour plane trip away. But again, with the virus restrictions, that might not be the wisest at the moment. But you know, rugby gave me a second chance in life and a second chance at rugby, and I'll be forever eternally grateful to them. So who knows in the future, you never know where you're going to end up, but I certainly would love to maybe in the future get back there, but we'll just wait and see.
So what was life like there besides the sun?
A bit of wine drinking was not too bad, but no, it's just culturally, it's totally different. It's just the pace of life is certainly different. The siestas from 12:30 to 3:30 are completely different, and the way in which rugby is done in Italy is completely different to Ireland. So you know, you obviously have a huge presence in schools rugby here, but in Italy they actually don't play any team sports within the school. They're all club based. So they, whenever, you know, they finish school, they're maybe at, you know, 6 o'clock in the evening, they're at their club playing rugby. So it's a totally different way of doing things. But you know, I know Italian rugby gets a fair bit of stick, you know, with the first team, but it's definitely an improving nation.
And is it still just very much played in pockets, rugby in Italy, or would it be at this stage reaching out nationally?
Yeah, I mean, you pick up the local newspapers, the La Gazzetta, and if there's about 50 pages of that, 48 of them are about soccer.
Yeah.
One about basketball, and then half a page about rugby. So it is followed, but it's just eclipsed by football. But there's huge numbers, and you know, basically from Rome up northwards is where rugby is played, not so much in the south, even though there are a couple of teams, but that's predominantly where you would find your players.
We got a hint of the Italian there, the accent, when you said La Gazzetta. It was
also the pausing, which my friends always give out.
A little flourish there. So I presume you're pretty fluent, and you must have gotten to grips with that fairly well at this stage.
Again, I was thrown in pretty much at the deep end. I remember when I moved over as a 22-year-old, my first class was, or my first rugby lesson was in a school trying to, you know, promote rugby, and there was about 50 teenagers there, and just me, didn't have one word of Italian, and you know, they took the mickey out of me. So that continued basically for about a year until I was able to pick it up, and it's a good language, it's a decent language, so it's became easier as well whenever you're hanging around constantly with Italians, and obviously having to play out half, you need to communicate everything in Italian, and then playing maybe for the more professional teams, you were able to speak maybe both. But
And did you take to having a siesta in the afternoon?
especially during pre-season, why wouldn't you with the heat? So yeah, particularly in August time, it's crazy hot, gets up to, you know, near 40 degree heat, so there's actually not much you can do. It's almost like the equivalent of a torrential downpour in Ireland. There's actually not much you can do in that period. So whenever you're training, you just generally you slept at that time.
Yeah,
maybe not for a full 4 hours.
Your career is just so remarkable, really. I mean, I don't know what the odds on everything conspiring the way they did are, but they're long, that's for sure. I mean, really, from 2010, when the initial eye injury happened, everything about what's transpired, like such a remote chance of it happening. Do you kind of scratch your head a little bit and look back on the various kind of key points along the way and almost think of, you must have had about a half a dozen sliding doors moments?
Yeah, I mean, I think people who maybe are familiar with my story, they will know that I always allude to my support network that helped me get back on my feet, because I really did hit the bottom of the barrel and was really struggling mentally with giving up the game. And, you know, they picked me up when I needed it most. So, listen, I think just the biggest thing for me is just getting the recognition that you're a rugby player again, you know, not the trying to step away from the Ian McKinley of the rugby goggles. And I know it's interesting for people whenever they see something for the first time, it would always draw attention. Mm. And I can imagine that the goggles would have. But now, you know, particularly in Italy, when I played there, there was never any mention of it. And I was just seen as a normal rugby player. And if, you know, you made a good decision on the field, you got the plaudits. And if I missed a kick, which unfortunately happened a few times, sometimes maybe I would blame the blind spot, but generally guys would just take you at face value, and you just as another, you're basically just another player, which I wouldn't expect it any other way, you know.
But the goggles, which effectively, as I understand it, you pioneered with the help of somebody from the National College of Art and Design, I think Johnny Merrigan is his name, they have become rather commonplace now. Lots and lots and lots of athletes all around the world are using them.
Yeah, so there's 2,000 people registered using them.
2,000, right.
Worldwide, so that's a mixture of adults and children. So, yeah, that part of it is probably the piece that I'm most proud of, is that it's giving other people the opportunity to partake in sport, because it's actually been amazing since sort of I got back to playing in 2014, the amount of messages you receive from people saying that they have a similar issue, or they know someone, or their child is really struggling with vision loss or some sort of similar problem. So that's, you know, for me, gave me a huge motivating factor, and still does, still receive messages weekly. So as I said, that's really been the part that I've been probably most proud of.
Mm. For people vaguely aware of your story, just to recap relatively briefly, because I'm sure you've told it a bunch of times, it was playing with UCD, I think in 2010, where you lost sight in your left eye. I think there was raking at the bottom of a ruck. It turned out actually by your own teammate, although at the time you thought something nefarious had happened. I think you were quite angry initially, but then it turned out it was just freak accident.
Yeah, everything about it was just wrong place, wrong time. Was at the bottom of the ruck, and I went for a big rip on the ground just for possession of the ball. And yeah, just all, next thing I remember was just an almighty bang, an almighty clatter in my face. And next thing, just the left side of my face went completely black, and the vision went completely. So unfortunately, my teammate's stud went into my eyeball, and my eyeball burst. So it was, you know, just literally everything that shouldn't have been there at the one time was. And I was rushed straight away to the eye and ear, where I had emergency surgery, and the surgeons there managed to save the eye. Gradually got vision back to, got it up to about 50% after about 6 months, was back on the field, and played under Joe Schmidt in his first year. The vision continuously improved to about 70%, and then the worst case scenario of my retina detaching happened, and that just left me completely blind. So if I'm to cover up my right eye now, I just see complete black. I can't even really distinguish light in a room, or just about if it's a sunny day, I can tell that it's that the sun is out.
Right. And Ian, the retina detached just sitting in the car at traffic lights.
Yeah, it was just bizarre. I mean, I was with a few of the other Leinster guys at the time, and yeah, I just looked up at the traffic lights and I just couldn't distinguish the colours at all. And nothing had really happened before that, in the sense that I didn't have this dramatic loss from when the accident initially happened. So I knew there was something dramatically wrong and went to the hospital again, and they just said, yeah, the morning after I had my last operation, they just said that the retina is completely gone and it's the tear is three times bigger than what we can do. So that's still the hardest thing I've ever had to do, is make that decision age 21 to stop, because just there were so many factors that, you know, that led me to the decision. But still the hardest thing that I've ever had to do, walking into Joe Schmidt's office.
Mm. Is the primary reason, well, I can't afford to risk losing sight in my other eye, or is it something totally different?
Yeah, so I sat down with my dad, who is a man of great wisdom, and he just said, you know, maybe just lay out the positives and the negatives. And sort of the factors that came back to me were that my eye was still incredibly painful. It was really very, very sore after all the operations. My depth perception was really bad. So simply pouring water into a glass, I was missing it by 3 feet. Mm-hmm. And then there were, you know, a few unsavory incidents of gouging in my good eye when I got back playing, which made me think, you know, do I really want to risk losing complete eyesight for the sake of rugby, even though rugby is a massive part of my life? So they were the three factors that led me to making the decision. And then sort of, I suppose people will go, well, why on earth are you back onto a rugby field? And I just said that if I ever was to step back onto a field, it would be with some form of protection, and there was no eye protection. So when we went looking in 2013, we managed to basically push the project along. I think some people think that I came up with or have been part of the design process, but it's literally just been getting the correct people meeting at the right times and basically pushing it over the line.
The eye gouging incidents, I remember reading about them in time, and they just jumped out as extraordinary under the circumstances. Did that happen playing for Leinster, or was that AIL level? And
AIL.
Do you suspect that, frankly, you were targeted? Like, do you think people knew Ian McKinley has had this issue with his eye, he's played for Leinster, I'm going to, you know, make a name against this fella? Or do you think that was just a freakish and terrible coincidence?
Out of the two, I know one is a lot more serious than the other. Right. So it's definitely, I've gone on record before, you know, it's not the part of the story that I like to dwell on, but it is the reason that I wear the goggles. No other factor involved, just 100% protection and safety that the goggles give me. Some people think that it actually improves my vision. It actually impairs it even more, just due to the padding, and it gives me 10 degrees less than what I would normally have. So that's just the sole reason that I'd wear them, yeah.
You seem like a pretty level-headed fella, not prone to losing your temper too badly. If I felt somebody had deliberately tried to eye gouge me and I'd lost sight in one eye and potentially they were risking my sight full stop, I don't know what I'd be held accountable for my actions. How did you react?
Yeah, pretty lucky that I had good teammates around me, so they were able to reprimand the guy pretty quickly. I remember Johnny Sexton's brother Mark. He was playing with me, and he was in fairly quickly, sorting the situation out. So listen, you have some guys that maybe lose their head, lose their temper. I was just there to play rugby and get on with my life again. So they're unsavory incidents, but I've parked them. And,
sure.
I've tried to move on as best I can.
Were they dealt with properly at the time, officially?
Probably not as much as you want, but there's no video evidence or anything like that. Okay. So you're just going on one player's word against another.
Okay. So effectively, you had to retire for those very understandable reasons. And I know you went to Italy to do some coaching and had to say, I'm not Ian McKinley, rugby player anymore. Mm-hmm. That was not easy for you, understandably. I would, frustrated, bitter, angry, you know, sad, I would think, as well, that you're playing for Leinster under Joe Schmidt, having come back from this initial, you know, devastating injury and getting 70% of your vision back to it going completely, and then for the reasons you've outlined, having to retire. Tell us about that period where you're retired and you're coaching in Italy with no Italian, just to make things easier on yourself.
Yeah, I suppose Ireland is such a small place and the rugby community is even smaller in Ireland. So I think I was really, you know, taken aback by the support of everyone. You know, that was the various clubs that I was with, whether it was the Pro or AIL. But I absolutely hated being talked about in the past, present, and, you know, in the past, and that you were a great player and you were able to do these things. And it just sort of, I suppose, gave me probably a chip on my shoulder. And, you know, I just needed to go somewhere completely different, which ended up being Italy. And it was just perfect for me because I could create my own little home there or create my own little piece of history and whatnot. So do you mean
like you could suddenly avoid going for a morning coffee and bumping into someone going, geez, I saw you play for the Irish under-20s, you were brilliant in your day, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't, you know, a Brian O'Driscoll or one of these, you know, famous names going around, but it did happen on a couple of occasions where I went to a bar and someone would go up and say, geez, I remember playing against you last year, such a pity, and you were a great player and all this, and such a pity. So I just, after a while, that just really got to me. So I suppose just the moving over gave me a new lease of life, but it was definitely, yeah, it was just very difficult. And I think I thought if I worked triple the amount that I should, I would just forget about what happened to me. And it probably really only hit me, I would say, the retirement and everything that went on in that 18-month period. It only hit me about a year and a half later. And that's when I had, you know, my little big cry with my brother, and he took me under his arm, and that's sort of where the momentum shift came for finding out about these goggles.
Okay. So you have that moment with your brother where I guess it approaches rock bottom and there's a grieving aspect to it. Is it at that point that you say, well, let's reinvestigate if I can play rugby? That's kind of where that started.
Yeah, there was a couple of things. There was the unfortunate Nevin Spence family tragedy was that happened 6 weeks when I moved over to Italy. And I remember getting a phone call from one of my very close friends in the middle of the night and just said that he's dead. And I said, who's dead? And it's Nevin Spence. And you look on the BBC website and there you see a companion, a guy who you roomed with, who you know you went to battle with on a rugby field, and him and his two of his family members are gone. And that all stuck in the back of my mind, thinking that he would have given any part of his body to play for Ulster and Ireland. And I think that just sort of kicked me into gear later on, saying, well, you have absolutely no right, Ian, to not at least give it a go, because what would, I suppose, Nevin do in that situation? Or he doesn't have that opportunity again. You still have your full body, you've got your legs, you've got your arms, and you've got no vision in your left eye. So just basically get up and do it. But I needed the tools to be able to help me with it. So my brother was able to provide that with various people and people who are a lot more skilled than himself, than my brother and me. And they were able to push us in the right direction. And again, with World Rugby's help, and we were able to get the goggles. And I suppose the rest is history.
Yeah, and that brings in Johnny Merrigan. I know I've seen him mentioned in places. He was with the National College of Art and Design and developed those goggles, which is, you know, extraordinary to think they're being worn by 2,000 people around the world now. I mean, in some ways, that's the biggest legacy of all of that. That's an extraordinary thing, to have 2,000 people playing sport who might otherwise not be. So out half in particular, I mean, I get it if you're kind of a front rower, head down, work rate, but like the very definition of being an out half is to be seeing things around you, you know, vision. We will talk about an out half's vision at all times. How limited did you feel when you first tried to play again?
Yeah, my first game back was in City of Chi, so the lowest club level that you could possibly find in Italy. So the level was poor, and the guys that I would play with will tell you exactly the same. But it was perfect for me because it was just, I suppose, a building block to getting, one, my confidence back, seeing the goals were safe for me and safe for other players. The game itself was absolutely teeming down with rain the day before, the morning of the game. The pitch was so flooded, a mud bath. So it was really, like, the best way I can describe whenever you're playing with goggles in rain is when you're driving a car and you've just got no wipers for when it rains. And it gets to that sort of stage with the fog and everything like that. So that's what they were like initially. They're much better now due to, years of technology and investment and maybe understanding from the players that have used them. So listen, it was just perfect for me to get back and just get that feeling of just playing rugby. And yeah, I mean, there were things that are very difficult, certain lines in rugby, pop passes that are effectively, I'm throwing blind because I'm left footed and I'm blind in my left eye. Kicking did become, or was, a bit more tricky, so I had to try and adapt how I kicked. I still have never been fully satisfied with how I've actually ended up doing that. I still think there's a huge amount to improve on. And just simply passing, the catch pass, so the depth perception is still not 100%, so you just need to constantly work. And a doctor even gave me a little tip of, normally when you catch a ball, you're just waiting for it. He told me, how about putting your hands up towards the ball, and your depth perception is not as compromised. So that's, those little things have helped me hugely, and it's basically just training most days.
Mm. What adjustment do you have to make with your kicking?
Yeah, so sometimes if I leave the ball out, I can't see it. So I've had to turn my body angle. Again, it's always a work in progress. I'm not fully satisfied whatsoever with what I've done with it. But that's also the thing that, excited me in, say, in this six-year period from 2014, that just these things threw up so many different challenges that some people wouldn't have thought about. But again, you never make excuses for it. And especially when you go up to the highest level, you can't have any weaknesses. You work on, and I would never make an excuse for it. But yeah, there were certainly times that were challenging, I'll give you that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I can suddenly, I can visualize in my head now, if you're kicking off your left foot and you're letting that ball drop from, say, your hands over to your left side, if you can't see it anymore. I mean, yeah. did it take long to get to a point where automatically, because it's one thing, I suspect, doing it in training consciously to doing it automatically in a split second in a game. Did it take a long time, or how long did it take to get to a point where you felt like all the adjustments, be it your hands up earlier for the ball or your body angle when you're kicking, that they just became automatic?
Yeah, it was just a constant work in progress. I suppose I'm still not satisfied with what I've done, if I'm to be totally honest, right? Because there are, when you look back in games, there are certainly things that, maybe to someone who doesn't follow rugby as much, there's no difference, but I would notice. So again, it's just, that's, I suppose, the whole exciting part of it has been that you just find something else to work on. I know coaches go on constantly now about the work-ons and, the little details you need to win rugby games. And for me, that really does mean that I need to work on the most basic things of, right, catch pass, kick, place kicking, playing under floodlights with the goggles when there's a bit of a shine and all that sort of stuff, a glare with the goggles, some people might not realize. So certain things like that you need to adapt your training session, but that's what also kept the mind fresh, I would say.
Did it change the type of player that you had been?
Yeah, I suppose that's a good question. I think, experience is a good old thing. I've been asked previously, do you think you were a stronger player when you were in Ireland or when you were in Italy? And that's an easy one, because with, experience is a great thing, and you're able to learn from losing games, winning games, and climbing up the ladder. So like, I don't think I'm too different. There's certainly some aspects that I know that are probably that I probably not maybe as strong as what I was, but there are a lot of areas now that I'm a lot stronger than what I was. And also as well, rugby is developing dramatically every few years. So the difference from when I stepped off the rugby field in 2011 to when I stepped back on it in 2014, it was dramatic.
Did you have to make certain accommodations or allowances to yourself, you know, that you might talk to a player who's 34, 35, and they just have to accept they're not going to react as quickly or get to that ball the way they might have when they were a 22-year-old. Did you have to almost cut yourself some slack and say, right, I just can't spend the next 5 years being frustrated. I can't do X, Y, and Z, which I used to be able to do.
No, because I know what I can do. So I think that was also one of the things that made my brother really involved in the project as well of getting me back, because he saw that I was still able to, you know, pass accurately for 20 meters or kick off the tee, do a drop goal, still do all the basic essentials that an out half can do and tackle properly. So I think if he thought that I wasn't able to do those things anywhere near to the level that I had done previously, then it would have been, well, maybe we need to curtail the expectation levels here. But it's literally, it's honestly, when people describe, you know, journeys as a roller coaster, this certainly has been. I knew whenever I went back and started playing in 2014, I knew that I could get back to the level that I had stopped previously. But it's also important as well, every landmark that you arrived at, you needed to celebrate it as well. So I certainly, I suppose now, given the coronavirus time, is a good time, as good a time as any, to sort of just step back, take a little breather, and, you know, as I said, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, sure. I mean, to celebrate achievements, to go from that wet pitch at the lowest tier of Italian rugby to playing Six Nations games for Italy and standing there for the anthem and even playing against Ireland, and, you know, I'd say half the country were really, really hoping you did really well. To hit that level is quite the achievement. I mean, it's one thing getting into Benetton and being paid to play rugby, but then the residency rule kicked in to play international rugby, Six Nations games. That must, I hope you did celebrate that and did acknowledge that, like, this is a serious achievement now.
Yeah, probably not as much as I should have, but I remember, and this will always stick with me. So I remember we were in preparation, I think it was, for the Heineken Cup. It was either the quarterfinal or semifinal against Leicester, to lose with Leinster in 2011. And I remember Brian O'Driscoll just said, he was talking about being a professional and how we need to be all professional in this period. And, you know, it's one thing to play. He made a reference to Ireland, said it's one thing to play for Ireland. It's another thing to play well for Ireland. So I think that I only sort of understood that now when I've had 9 games for Italy. And it is one thing to get to the international stage, but to play well at international rugby is another thing. And I suppose I still, you know, looking back on the games that I've played, would not be satisfied with about 8 of them. So I think that's just a competitive edge that all sports people have. And, you know, you alluded to the Irish games there, and you know, they were momentous occasions. So the first game we played against Ireland in Chicago, well, it was really emotional, of course. But at the end of the day, we lost by 50 points. I mean, who wants to lose some of your really good mates by 50 points? I mean, that's not good. Who wants to, you know, miss a kick in the Six Nations to possibly get a losing bonus point to, in front of your own home fans? You know, but that's sort of maybe the way I think. But of course, maybe when I'm sitting in my chair, rocking chair, when I'm about 80, I can go, well, you know, that at least I gave him my best shot.
If this was, for whatever reason, the end of the playing career, now aged 13, are you more prepared to say goodbye to rugby and to be former rugby player Ian McKinley now, or will it still be very difficult?
Oh, I think it would still be very difficult, but I've been fortunate enough to make sure that I have a plan B in place, which I think even if you're to look at Sergio Parisse now, who's, you know, in his late 30s, I don't think you're you know, in comparison to him retiring, and someone then like Jack Clifford was at to retire at 27,
yeah,
you're never ready. You know, that's the real challenge. Some guys' bodies might give up, but mentally you always believe that you can go on. So it's an extremely difficult period for any sporting athlete to know when their race has been run. But I definitely, the experience of having retired for that 3-year period will stand to me. And, you know, again, I'm just fortunate to have to have the people around me to help me achieve that. So I count myself very fortunate.
You were obviously in the north of Italy during the COVID crisis and lockdown, and Italy had the misfortune of being first up from a European point of view and probably totally, you know, ill-equipped to deal with it. And we saw the footage over here and watched on in horror, you know, and thankfully we had a bit more time to prepare. What was it like for you? Was it, were you kind of caught up in any great way, or was it just lockdown and hoping?
Yeah, so we were based in, myself and my wife were in Treviso, so it was about 3 hours east of where the breakout happened, and that was in Bergamo.
Bergamo, yeah.
So yeah, no, it was definitely for 2.5 months. It was, you know, no further than 200 meters in your from your apartment or where you lived. There was police drones checking. I remember one of my teammates was 300 meters from his house, walking his dog, and the police were there reprimanding him, saying you got to be no more than 200. And so they were very strict. So it was a scary time. Just the all you could hear was ambulance sirens going every 10 minutes. It was just crazy. Now, whether that was because there was no traffic, nobody out, but it was literally every 10 minutes. If you were on a call, you'd have the sirens going on in the back. And in terms of training, it was pretty tricky because there was no greenery around. So you just had to make do. And Benetton, in fairness to them, were pretty good and swift in their approach. They opened up the gym. So guys, if they wanted to take dumbbells or plates or whatever, if you had a garage, you could just put them there and train away. So that's what I did for 2.5 months, and just running around my apartment block for about half an hour.
Yeah, I can imagine what it was like, even just the sound of sirens going off that often. I mean, geez, constant reminder that you're in the thick of it.
Yeah. I think just the unknown, and everything was being delayed sort of 3 weeks at a time. So we were just sort of hoping that it was going to stop at some stage, and luckily enough, it sort of improved slightly.
So for the foreseeable, you're coaching now at Rainy Old Boys, backs coach, and you're still only 30. It's a TBC stage in your career. Playing may still arise. I mean, I don't know, did Benetton say we may be in touch, we may not? Does it depend on finances? Are you still very much in the dark? No, that's done.
No, with Benetton, and I had a fantastic 4 years there, but they're in pretty good hands with the tens they have there at the moment. You know, there's the three of them, so they're pretty solid there. So it's a good club, it's a growing club, and it's a fantastic city. And you know, I think it's just particularly last year when we reached the playoffs, that was a real milestone for Italian rugby to show, you know, that the talent really is there. And that's also, I suppose, that gets the chip on my shoulder about that as well, because people would say, you know, Italy's terrible, or Italy, you know, they can never win games. But if people only really realize the talent there, it's just maybe, I suppose, a structural thing that, you know, they're just a little bit behind. We're a little bit behind in comparison to Ireland, in comparison to other nations. But I'm so convinced, you know, whenever that day arrives, that you know, those appropriate measures can be put in place, Italy will be a pretty tough rugby nation, because they have a good combination between skill set and just sheer toughness and aggression, and, you know, physical defense, which is obviously becoming a lot more important in the game.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would be great, and the Six Nations needs it. You know, I mean, you don't want Italy to be talked in terms of, well, do they need to be relegated, or what are they bringing to the Six Nations? I got the distinct impression Conor O'Shea was trying to bring as much as a winning mentality to the first team, also a better structure to the game generally there.
Yeah, I mean, Conor, you know, very well thought after, but it's... you know, as I said, it's tough whenever structures are not fully in place. So, I mean, you only have to look at Ireland during the 90s. I mean, Ireland won 12% of their international games. So I know it's incredibly difficult because I've sat in that changing room after loss after loss with Italy, and what is it now, 20 odd, you know, more than 20 odd games in a row lost with the Six Nations. I mean, it doesn't make for good reading, but you know, I'm so convinced that if you can get a consistent basis with the underage, which if you look at results gone by in the last sort of 5 years with the Italian under 20s, if we can get these guys in a proper training environment, then that'll just naturally progress. And then once you get the clubs, Treviso and Zebre, competing consistently, then that will just naturally filter into the first team.
Well, listen, Ian McKinley, as I said at the outset, Ian, you've lived like the most remarkable rugby life. I mean, Jesus, it's just the most incredible story. Best of luck with Rainy Old Boys over the foreseeable, and sure, by the sounds of things, we might see you togging out somewhere in the foreseeable future as well, regardless of what happens. Ian McKinley, thanks so much, Ian.
No worries. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.